and welcome again to the Ask Beattie Show. And isn't it the truth, my friends, that regardless of whether or not we're rich or poor or black or white or Jewish or Christian or Muslim or gay or straight or gen, we certainly all go through so many ups and downs in our lives. And over the last number of weeks, I was thinking about how really, really brave it is for people to make a decision and reach out and ask for help. It's not an easy thing to do. It's not an easy thing to acknowledge to oneself that one's life is really spinning out of control, that you feel that you're on a never-ending roller coaster ride or a merry-go-round ride that is not a fun ride. And yet what I have been finding more and more, and I think more in the last 6 months than I have in a long, long time, is how resistant so many people are, including, I have to tell you, my own patients, when it comes to really doing what is in their best interest, whether or not we're talking about people who are suffering from depression. Now, for example, in the country, there are 16 million adults in the United States who are suffering from true clinical depression, and that translates into 1 in 5 Americans. 40 million people are suffering from a variety of anxiety disorders. And then there are people who have substance abuse problems, and of course, relationship problems. Everybody is always complaining and talking about the relationship issues. And yet again, one has to be honest and really serious if you really want to look at oneself and change the configuration of how your life is going. And this is not merely just about talking and expressing one's feelings. It's really about being serious about understanding what did and what perhaps did not happen in one's family of origin, processing all of this emotionally, because one really has to understand how things got started in the beginning of one's life. And of course, the beginning of one's life, whether we want to admit it or not, really does begin with our own family and what did and what may not have happened in our own families of origin, whether or not you're talking about abuse of various different kinds, emotional abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, verbal abuse, or neglect. Because what I have found is that unless one really goes through that process, and it's not a fun process, it's not a tea party by any stretch of the imagination, you really then live your life basically having 1 foot in the past and 1 foot in the present. But having gone through the process, one then has to make some decisions about whether or not people are serious about taking some new steps and walking in a new direction on a new path. And that too is something that is very, very challenging and difficult for a lot of people. I want to just tell you about a couple of people that I am currently treating, and of course I'm going to change a lot of the details to protect their anonymity and their confidentiality. The first woman that I have been treating now for about a month, let's call her Caroline. And Caroline is 45 years old, and she was living with a man for about 15 years. It was a really toxic relationship. He was an alcoholic. He used a variety of different drugs, recreational drugs, over-the-counter drugs. He was addicted to pornography. They had, and this is by her own admission, they had no communication, they had no problem-solving skills, and they also had no sex. So one might wonder why Caroline had wanted to stay in this kind of a relationship for 15 years. And during that 15-year period, she never thought about seeking professional help. So 15 years came and went, and last summer, the couple broke up. He left her, and it appeared that he left her for another woman. And naturally, after 15 years, there's going to be a lot of devastation and mourning, because the fact is that regardless of how bad sometimes our relationships are, people have fantasies and hopes and dreams, if they only press the right button, that somehow things are going to change. Of course, the reality is that that rarely, if ever, really happens. And what I've been trying to convince you over the past number of years, in fact, today is the 280th. I cannot believe it. Ask Beattie Show here on the Progressive Radio Network. And of course, what I've been trying to convince you about is that when there are issues, whether or not they are relationship issues or family issues or individual issues, the importance of our being willing and being serious to acknowledge and address and resolve the issues as best as we can, even though fortunately or unfortunately, we cannot change our history. And there is no shortcut. And I think that so many people, we want to deny and avoid and put our problems under the carpet or in a drawer, hoping miraculously that they are going to get resolved on their own. And of course, that is really pure fantasy. So getting back to Caroline, so she is devastated. She is devastated. This relationship has ended. And I've been working with her now for a very, very short period of time. And even though on a cognitive, on an intellectual level, she is one very, very smart woman in all kinds of ways, she acknowledges that the relationship was really very toxic, very destructive, and very self-destructive. And yet she wants this man back. So what we had talked about is that if he would be willing, and of course he's living with another woman right now, so the probability of that happening was not going to be very, very great. But what she wanted, and I think she had a secondary kind of an agenda, the hope was is that he was going to miraculously decide that he was going to come back to her. She wanted to hear from him what he felt, what went wrong, what happened in their relationship from his perspective that would then hopefully help her to move along. And she has been very, very honest with me about what she believes her role was. And of course, there was a lot of denial and a lot of avoidance, and she was over, you know, connected with her family and her friends. And the relationship, as they say, was really a very, very self-destructive and destructive relationship, basically for both of them. So he comes in for one session. And she was so open and so honest about what she wished that she had done differently. And he seemed to really appreciate the fact that she was willing to acknowledge a lot of things that she had never acknowledged, that they had never talked about in the past. But he made it very, very clear that he had no desire whatsoever to get back. He had done her a favor, and there was a little bit more unfinished business. There were some financial issues that they were hoping to be able to deal with in a follow-up session. Well, he canceled the session, and that was the end of any hope on Caroline's part that she was going to be able to get more insight into his perspective of what did and didn't happen. And of course, again, I think that she secretly, and really with me, it was not so secretly, she really was hoping that somehow he was going to decide that he was going to return. But unfortunately, this woman is having some real difficulty accepting the reality of the fact that this relationship is 100% over. and she is severely clinically depressed, and she is going to have to do a lot of work, not only looking at the reality of what the relationship was really like, and as I say, it was a really destructive and self-sabotaging and toxic relationship, but at the same time also, she's going to have to go through a significant mourning process, and her fears of being alone, her fears of never finding anybody else. I mean, these are all things that are factoring into her really severe clinical depression. And we had agreed that she does need some medication. I know that a lot of people are anti-medication, but there are situations. And I have been in the field now for over 35 years, and I can attest to the fact that even though diet and exercise and vitamins and supplements and therapy are all very, very important in helping people improve their mood, that there really are times when people do, in my opinion, need a little bit of extra help. And in this case, she is very much in need of some antidepressant medication, which she has agreed to take. So the process really goes on. And yet, I think that one of the challenges that I have moving forward is helping her to accept the reality that this relationship, not only was the relationship not a good relationship, but that the relationship is definitively 100% done. And that accepting that reality is something that she is going to have to do over a period of time in being able to really move on with her life. So I think that I have my work cut out for me. But as a therapist, I mean, this has been one of the great things over the past 35 years is that I have treated people from every walk of life with every conceivable kind of problem. And for me, it's been really a challenge. And of course, it's my passion in helping people to really get to the root of the problems and help them resurrect a life that is going to be a life that's really constructive and a life that they are going to be able to do things that are really in their best interest. And another patient of mine also has been suffering from severe clinical depression probably for most of her life. And she's had a lot of therapy, some good therapy, some not so good therapy. And my challenge with her right now, and I've been working with her for the last couple of years, is really getting her to stay on a constructive path and eliminate and eradicate the toxic people in her life. Now, unfortunately, her parents were very, very toxic. Her extended family have been extremely toxic. So what do you think happened in terms of her choices of men? She's heterosexual, that she has chosen over the years. One toxic relationship and one toxic man after another. So fortunately, this particular woman has really committed to learning, and I guess the proof is really in the pudding. It's not what you say, it's what you do. This woman has really committed to herself. It's not just to me, but to herself to learn the ABCs of successful relationship, and has promised moving forward that she is going to use my 10-step formula based on my research and based on my book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love, which teaches people really how to assess who's right for you and who's wrong for you before committing to any serious relationship. And the reality is, despite what a lot of people might tell you, the reality is that it is going to take some time to find out who somebody really is and who somebody is not. And my research found is that it takes close to a year to really go through the process, and that fortunately or unfortunately, we cannot fast forward the process. So with this particular woman, she started off in a relationship about a year ago, and things appeared to be looking really good. And this is interesting, and I use the word appear because before I did my research and before I wrote the book, I would meet someone, and this is my own personal confession. I would meet somebody and I'd say, oh, I met this terrific man, or I met this terrific woman. And after going through the process of the research and the writing and, of course, practicing for all of these years, I have learned that I would never, ever make a statement like that again. And when I speak at various different venues around the country, I'll say to audiences, what do you think that I might say? And, you know, people aren't sure. But the answer is that all I can say when I meet people, and I'm hoping that this is something that you are really going to take in seriously in your own life. All we can say is that we've met somebody who appears. And that is the key word, my friends, who appears to be great, and that we need to go through the process of discovery to find out who they are and who they are not. And in the world of relationships and romantic relationships, it's the unsexy things like communication and problem solving and emotional intimacy and sexual chemistry and finding out whether or not people have skeletons in their closet, like substance abuse of various different kinds, and whether or not they are abusive verbally or physically or sexually or emotionally. And again, we cannot fast forward that process. So it's kind of like playing out the points in a tennis match. You've got to hit the ball before we are going to be able to know whether you're going to win that game or whether or not you are going to be a winner of the match. And I think that so many of us were impatient. We want to know the end of the story. We want to know whether or not we are going to live happily ever after. And yet we have to be careful. We have to be honest with ourselves that if we are observing things in our relationships, whether or not it's at work, whether or not it's at home, whether or not we are dating, whether or not it is with family and our friends, we have to be honest with ourselves about behaviors that are toxic, behaviors that are destructive, behaviors that are self-destructive and self-sabotaging. And then we have a decision. We have a decision that we need to make. Are we going to do something about it? Are we going to ignore? Are we going to deny? Are we going to fantasize that somehow the problems are going to be eradicated on their own? Or are we going to be brave? And we don't need to be brave on our own, which is why I encourage you every week to really reach out and ask for help when life is starting to really, really get off track. And the bravery comes in our relationships when it's not when it's fun and not when it's just, where are we going to go for dinner or what kind of a vacation are we going to take? But it's when things get dicey, and that's where we need to have the courage and find the words and find the way to sit down with our partners or our family members or our colleagues and say, listen, there are some things that we do need to talk about. And when people are interested, when people really care about the relationships, and of course, that is something that you definitely, definitely are going to find out whether or not the person who you're wanting to try to work through issues with cares enough and is interested enough in you and in the relationship to do the work to acknowledge and address and resolve problems. But with this particular patient, I find that I'm constantly trying to pull her back on a constructive path because her tendency is to go back into the woods where it was that she began in her very abusive, toxic family. And she has said to me, and many, many patients over the years have said this to me, is that why does something, Beattie, so bad, so toxic, so much not in my best interest actually feel kind of comfortable and right? And of course, it's because people who have been used to things that have not gone well, that they have been used to bad relationship or toxic relationships, that's where they actually feel a level of comfort. And of course, in therapy, it is my job to make that level of comfort, that self-destructive, self-sabotaging level of comfort really go by the wayside. And I do hear this a lot. So why does something so bad feel okay? And then on the other hand, why does something so good feel so wrong? And this is where the therapeutic process, it's complicated and it takes time. And it takes people, clients and patients, an enormous amount of work and an enormous amount of bravery to be able to really look at their lives honestly and be willing and ready to make some major changes. And as a therapist, I think I'm fortunate. I have an enormous amount of patience, but oftentimes I feel like I'm throwing out, I'm casting out this rod, trying to pull people back onto a path, on a constructive path that is really in their best interest, whereas they, on the other hand, are pulling in the other direction in a path, in a place that is familiar to them, that is destructive and self-destructive. Well, doing therapy has always been my passion. And but needless to say, it is not a piece of cake. And if you are planning yourself to, to reach out and find a good therapist, please do your homework, because all therapy and all therapists are absolutely not the same. And I really suggest that you do get a referral from somebody that you actually trust, who has had their own experience or has been a colleague who really understands what this person's therapeutic orientation and what the therapeutic process is actually like. Well, moving on, we are in the midst, of course, of holiday time. And yet for a lot of people, holiday time is a very, very difficult time. And there was a piece in the New York Times last week. The heading was, yes, it's okay to be sad during the holidays. And I think that many, many people realize this. And sometimes the seasonal spirit, it just passes us by. And that's perfectly normal. And what we need to do, of course, is to find emotional support where you can and curb unrealistic expectations. If this year it is not a fun time in your life, then the $64,000 question is, okay, it is holiday time, so what do I need to do? What is going to be in my best interest during the next several weeks, even though that things are not in the place that I would have hoped for. So you have to ask yourself some very basic questions, and I want you to be really honest with yourselves. First of all, how do you want to spend the holidays, assuming that things are not copacetic, perhaps with your family or your friends? How do you want to spend the holidays? With whom do you want to spend the holidays? Who do you not want to spend the holidays with you? For example, if your family situation is really difficult, are you willing to make any kinds of compromises to be around your family? Maybe some compromises will be okay, but other compromises will be very self-destructive and destructive to you. So again, you have to look at the pros and the cons of who you want to be around during the holiday time. If you feel compelled, let's say you are in a situation where you don't want to see your family, perhaps a compromise that might work for you, and maybe it wouldn't, and that's okay too. Maybe you want to call, maybe you want to text rather than actually see the people in person. Or perhaps, and you know, I've said this to a number of people over the years, if you choose that you are going to spend any time with your family or friends, make sure that you actually have an exit plan. I mean, I've had situations with patients who've said to me, look, I cannot not go to Christmas dinner, as an example. But we had a game plan. If the Christmas dinner was turning chaotic, if the Christmas dinner was turning into a really, really toxic experience, I was able to help my patients to give themselves permission to exit the table, to exit the gathering, even before the main course was served. So I think, again, one has to look at, is this something that is really in my best interest? And if you still feel, even though it may not be ultimately in your best interest to be around certain people, an exit plan is really, really a good idea. You know, there was a patient of mine in Providence, and she had had a really horrific relationship with her mom, who had physically and sexually abused her during most of her early childhood. And this woman, as you can imagine, had significant problems with depression. She'd been in and out of psychiatric hospital. And when I started to work with her, she said, look, you know, I'm feeling a lot better, and maybe I'm going to be able to forge ahead and have a functional relationship with my mother. And so we decided that she was going to, it started on the phone, and the telephone conversations, they were okay. And she decided that she wanted to try and meet with her mom once a month for dinner. And so the dinners began. And she learned before the dinners, before she went out for the outing, that if her mother started, and you know what I mean by started, in any way to put her down, to criticize her, if she started to feel badly about the interaction, that she would excuse herself. And this was even before the waitress or the waiter would bring the water. And this woman, she trained horses. And what was so interesting about what happened with her mother over a period of time is that she was actually able to train, in quotes, her mom to behave properly, because there were a couple of times that she did leave before the main course arrived. And the mother obviously was wanting to have some kind of a relationship with her daughter. And this was a situation that actually worked out pretty well. But you may decide that you don't want to have anything to do with the holidays at all. You may decide that you're going to do your hair or take a bubble bath or just hang out and buy yourself a really terrific dish or dishes of some kind. watch movies, stay home, take a walk, go to the gym, and basically just forget the whole thing. And if you do that, that's terrific, because that is your choice and you've made a decision that you want to do things that are actually in your best interest. And for this year, that may be exactly how you want to spend your time. But there's some other options too that I really, you know, want all of us to think about, and that is volunteering. There are so many people who would absolutely love to be able to see you and talk to you. And research from the scientific journal Nature Communications, I've never heard of that journal, but it is a journal, found that performing acts of generosity, and isn't that the truth, lights up the reward system in the brain, brightening not only our days, but someone else's too. So volunteering at a soup kitchen, donating funds, although my bias is the face-to-face communications of giving, and resources to a homeless shelter, or buying lunch for a friend just because you never know, and it's so true, you will never know who you're going to meet or what sort of positive emotions that you are going to find along the way. And that is about really creating our own happiness, because only once you've found the source of your sadness can you reasonably find joy. And this is according to Gretchen Rubin, who is the author of The Happiness Project: Negative Emotions Are Tools That Guide You to Feel Better. Hopefully so, because you have to ask yourself some pointed questions like this. Given that I feel this negative emotion, whatever the emotion is, anger or pain or disappointment, and of course, I don't even like the term negative emotions. They are emotions. They are actually good emotions, because that's how you really feel. They are the ways that I can do something in my own circumstances that can make me feel better. So, for example, Ms. Rubin suggests, if the holidays remind you of a family member who's died, okay, she suggests deciding whether it feels more comforting to honor that person with a tradition you once shared, or to break free of the past. And that's really interesting. You know, and there isn't, and I want to just assure you that it's not about right or wrong. It is about doing what is right for you. Or let's say you haven't received invitations to events and you feel left out. Create your own. It's so true. And invite only those whose company you enjoy, or plan an office party to lift morale. Because you want to take the pressure off by focusing on connecting with friends or family, as opposed to following traditions of the holiday that may not work for you today. And if you feel guilty about abstaining from festivities altogether, make a list of five. And this is what Miss Rubin suggests. She says, make a list of five priorities that you can accomplish to give your holiday season purpose in a way that feels meaningful to you. And she says, in my observation, it's helpful to try to be as specific as possible about why you're having so-called negative emotions. And if you're sad because you want to make friends, going to a holiday party would be helpful. So it's always about, or it needs to be, at least in my view, always about problem solution. And again, I want to repeat this, that performing acts of generosity for others lights up the reward system in the brain, brightening not only your day, but someone else's too. So you need to make some decisions, right, about how you want to celebrate the holidays. And I think that you should just try and give yourself permission to put away the shoulds of what you feel you should be doing, and rather to sit quietly with yourself and ask yourself the question. And I talk about this a lot in my therapy sessions, and of course a lot on the Ask Beattie show, to be thinking about on an ongoing basis, what is in my best interest? Is this good for me? Is this bad for me? I'm not sure if it's good or if I'm not sure if it's bad, to take the time to figure it out. And in that way, you're going to be able to stop yourself, because you need to have this cognitive perspective on this. You're going to stop yourself from engaging in behaviors and engaging with people who are really situations, behaviors, and people who are not in your best interest. So please give yourself permission to take the time to actually do this. Over the weekend, there was a really, really upsetting piece that actually a patient of mine emailed to me in the New York Times. And the heading, "The Crisis in Youth Suicide." All right. Too often, suicide attempts and deaths by suicide, especially among the young, become family secrets that are not investigated and dealt with in ways that might protect others from a similar fate. And this is an article by Jane Brody. In October, the Centers for Disease Control, now I don't know how many of you are grandmothers or grandfathers or parents of teenagers, but these statistics really, really freaked me out and shocked me. So in October, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported that after a stable period from the year 2000 to 2007, the rate of suicide among those aged 10 to 24 increased dramatically. How dramatically? By 56% between 2000 and 2017, making suicide the second leading cause of death in this age group, following accidents like car crashes. So we are in the middle of a full-blown mental health crisis for adolescents and young adults, said Jean M. Twang. And she is a research psychologist at San Diego State University and the author of the book, iGen. And I really like to have her on the show. I'm going to call her next week and see whether in the new year we can have an interview. So she has written about mental health trends among those born since 1995. And the evidence, unfortunately, is strong and consistent, both for symptoms and behavior. So along with suicides, since 2011, there's been nearly a 400% increase nationally in suicide attempts by self-poisoning among young people. I mean, what is that all about? Self-poisoning. Suicide attempts by the young have quadrupled over 6 years, and that is likely an undercount, said a man whose name is Henry Spiller, who was the director of the Central Ohio Poison Center, who called the trend devastating. And these are just the ones that are showing up in the emergency rooms. Had any other, and this is so true, had any other fatal or potentially fatal condition leapfrogged like this, the resulting alarm would surely have initiated a frantic search for its cause and cure. But way too often, suicide attempts and deaths by suicide, especially among the young, become family secrets that are not investigated and dealt with in ways that might protect others from a similar fate. We're at a point now, says John Ackerman, who is a clinical psychologist and coordinator of suicide prevention at Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus, Ohio. We're at a point where this issue cannot be ignored any longer. We invest heavily in crisis care, which is the most expensive at least effective means of preventing suicide, and it is also the least effective means in dealing with a variety of problems. It's like, what happened? What happened to the notion of preventative education, whether or not we're talking about preventative relationship education, whether or not we're talking about preventative domestic violence abuse education? I mean, we're always coming in after the fact, and that people get really upset. How could this be happening? Well, we need to do a much, much, much better job in preventative education. So he proposed that instead, of course, more time and money be spent on identifying kids who are at risk and who are most vulnerable, helping them respond effectively to stress, and teaching them what they can do and that it is okay to reach out for help when they are in a state of crisis. And we need to start early in the elementary school grades. Well, for those of you who've been listening to the last 280 Ask Beattie shows, you know that I was one of three people who ran the entire school social services program for all of the elementary, junior high, and high schools in Greater Montreal. And in those days, we were not concerned about budgets. We were concerned about social services, and we were concerned about preventative social services programs. And I had carte blanche, and I was able to design in those days, relationship education programs beginning at the first grade level. And I will never forget this. You know, I used to go into the classes, and then, of course, I taught my staff. I had a very large staff to go in, and we taught the kids about emotions, and we taught the kids about, you know, how to say it if you're upset or you're angry or you're disappointed or you're afraid or you're angry. And this is what we need to be doing. We need to be identifying situations early on. We need to be teaching our children early on about emotions, about relationships, about problems, and that it is above all that it is okay to reach out and ask for help. And of course, with our social services program, all of the schools in Greater Montreal, they bought into the program. So there were school psychologists and school social workers and nurses and vice principals and psychologists. And we all worked together to intervene and to identify early on children that were having behavioral problems, children that were having academic problems, children that were having problems at home. And we did not wait for the crises. The teachers, who of course spend the vast majority of time with the children and oftentimes much more time with the students than their own parents, they were able to get to know these kids really, really well. And they were able to see if kids were depressed, if kids were anxious, if kids were not learning well. And it was never about putting a bandage on the problem. It was always about trying to figure out what was really going on with these young children. Why were they not learning? Were there family problems? Was a situation where they did not have enough food at home? Were they not getting enough sleep? Was there abuse going on in the house? And in those days, the social workers, and when I began myself as a school social worker, I routinely made home visits. I don't know how many people make home visits these days. you know, people who are working in the schools, to try to be able to get to know the families, to try to be able to engage the families and have the families see us as members of a team, and that they were also going to be members of a team that were wanting to do everything to do what was in their children's best interest. I mean, nobody's going to say that the science and the math and the history and the sociology and the psychology are things that children should not be learning. I mean, we need to learn all of these things, but we also need to prioritize children's mental health. And the schools have an opportunity, and we need to do a much, much, much better job in being able to make use of the opportunity that we have as academics to be able to identify early on and intervene early on before it's too late. And Dr. Achterman, he goes on to say that in Ohio, about 40,000 students have been screened for depression and suicide risk, and hundreds of kids have been linked to services. And it's not about putting ideas in their heads to ask directly whether they've had thoughts of suicide or dying. That does not increase their risk. It is a relief that somebody gets it, that somebody cares enough to find out how they are really feeling, because you actually reduce the risk if you help kids talk through these difficult feelings. And of course, it's not just helping kids, it's helping all of us talk through really difficult feelings rather than internalizing them. And although no one can say with certainty why suicide has become such a crisis among the young, experts cite several factors that parents, schools, and others might be able to modify or control. A Dr. Spiller, for example, attributes the rise in suicide attempts largely, and here we go again, to the effects of social media and how teens and young adults communicate with their peers. And we know that kids now, they never disconnect. I mean, they are connected 24/7. They go to bed with their smartphones. It may be cyberbullying. It may be envy. Maybe things are going on here that are just too difficult, you know, to deal with. I know that people, and all of the people these days, you know, are concerned, you know, how many followers, how many likes, who's ghosted us today? What a to-do, you know? And, you know, I'm finding myself that these days, you know, people, for example, meeting planners who are going to book me to speak at various different venues around the country, who would have ever dreamed that they would ask me, how many followers do I have? I mean, really? I frankly don't care how many followers I have, but the kids, they care a lot. And one thing that the research didn't find, which is also really interesting, was a link of teen suicides to the opiate crisis. Instead, in school-age adolescents, it found a rise, and this is interesting too, a rise in suicide attempts during the school months, September until December, then again January through May, which is very interesting. So when there were the breaks and holidays, the suicide attempts and the suicide rates seem to go down. And the researchers have also found that the rise in attempted and completed suicides by young people correlates directly with their access to smartphones. What are we going to do, since technology is definitely not going anywhere? 85% of teens are looking at social media. There's less face-to-face time spent with friends. It's now the norm. Can you believe this? to sit home Saturday night on Instagram. Who's popular? Who's not? Is now quantifiable. And of course it is, by how many people are following you. Kids are spending as much as 8 hours a day on social media, where there's a lot of negativity, a lot of negativity and shaming and blaming and competition and jockeying for status and unfiltered access to sites that tell us how to harm themselves. And Dr. Ackerman, who noted that young brains are less apt at dealing with complex situations. So there is some advice, okay? And parents need to really get on with this program to help the kids avoid looking at the devices within an hour of bedtime. Let them just relax and get away from the technology and get away from the phones and maybe buy an alarm clock so that you're going to have a sense that about an hour before bedtime, maybe it would be just a good idea to have a nice hot shower or have some conversation with your parents or with your siblings or with a friend so that you're going to be able to wind down in a really, really peaceful way. And experts are also urging parents to check in with their teenage kids regularly. Okay, parents, grandparents, teachers, asking how they're feeling and whether or not they ever think about dying. As early as elementary school, children can have responsible conversation about suicide. And we as adults, not just talking about suicide, but we as adults, we have a responsibility to prepare young people to talk about their emotions early on in life. And that's something that we all certainly need to do a much, much, much better job. You know, have you asked your children, you know, how are you feeling about this friend, or how are you feeling about your work? And we need to, you know, we need to try to convince them on a very consistent basis that it is okay, that it is really, really okay to talk about our feelings. And when the kids will say to us, look, I don't really want to talk, you might, as a parent, want to say, well, listen, I understand that this may not be a good time to talk about this, but I'm really interested in what's going on with your friends. I'm really interested in how you're feeling that you did not get invited to the party. And I'm sure that that really hurts, so that we as the adults really have the responsibility to teach and encourage our children early on to be able to recognize their feelings and also to be able to express those feelings, because that's where we get ourselves into trouble early on in life, where we don't know exactly how to express, or whether we should express our feelings of anger or sadness or pain. And so oftentimes that people who are not able to do this, they are taking solace in quotes in alcohol or in prescription drugs or in pornography or in a variety of other activities, destructive, self-destructive, self-sabotaging activities that are absolutely not in our best interest. And I think as parents, I think that it is our responsibility also to talk to teachers and to talk to school administrators and to encourage them to be able to find some time during their busy, busy days of teaching math and science and history, even if it was 15 minutes a day, which is something that teachers all could find the time to do, to talk about the election, to talk about the debates, to talk about how the kids were feeling about a movie, to talk about how they were feeling about holiday celebrations. So, I mean, again, there are a lot of things that we can actually do to help promote adults and to help promote our children better be able to express their feelings and to be able to better problem solve when situations arise. See, today, before the show, I did something that was not in my best interest. Typically, I have a couple of glasses of water that are next to me, and I'm always very, very aware, especially if I don't have a guest, that that is something that is really important to do. And today, I inadvertently did not do it, so I am running into some difficulties. And again, you know, whether it's water or whether or not it's thinking about as we go through our days, whether the things that we are doing and the interactions that we are having and the behaviors that we are engaging in are really things that are in our best interest. And hopefully for next week and for all subsequent shows, I am going to be much more mindful of always having a glass of water next to me so that I'm not going to run into trouble. And I'm asking you to think about what are some of the things that you need to do that will make your life, will make your engagements, will make your relationships and your behaviors as you go through your day-to-day activities easier and better and much more constructive, so that you are not going to do what I did today.